Our second case this morning is 2020-1158, Stephen Sinley versus Safety Controls Technology, Inc. et al. For the appellant, Mr. Prietel.
Chief Justice O'Connor, Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio, and may it please the Court, Keith Prietel for the appellant, Superior Dairy, Inc. I would like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal, if I can. In 2014, as a result of severe losses and economic damages resulting from a federal lawsuit and defending that federal lawsuit, Superior Dairy and its collective bargaining partner, the union, Teamsters Local 92, amended what was other a bland, contract-only based grievance arbitration procedure that captured internal disputes within the collective bargaining agreement to now capture any statutory disputes. And they did that in two ways. First, under Article 9, Section 1, the Teamsters and Superior Dairy negotiated that the disputes or controversies arising under the terms of this agreement would be broadened to also include violations of any employment-related laws and statutes. Second, under Article 9, or Article 10, Section 4, the parties made the entire grievance arbitration procedure, Articles 9 and Article 10, equally applicable to any alleged violations of laws or statutes by the company or the union as alleged by an employee, and then including but not limited to, and then had a significant listing of statutes at that point in time.
Counsel, was this listed?
2745 was not specifically listed, Your Honor. It's our position here that it's captured within the two clauses, the grievance clause that was expanded to include any employment-related laws or statutes, as well as Article 10, Section 4, that includes not only contractual disputes, but put the whole grievance arbitration procedure available to any alleged violations of laws or statutes by the company or the union.
What does how does that fit with Penn Plaza?
So Penn Plaza was the first case to hold, of course, that you could effectively waive through a collective bargaining agreement.
Well, you could if it says an agreement to arbitrate statutory anti-discrimination claims, which is what that was about, must be explicitly stated in the collective bargaining agreement. But you couldn't waive it. Yes.
Yes. And it's our position that the courts over the years, in terms of determining what is a clear and unmistakable waiver, have said it includes language such as ours, that any employment-related laws or statutes or any statutes or laws are included within that. And the reason for that is Wright, which was the predicate one, the predecessor to Pyatt, said specifically, that you had to have a clear and unmistakable waiver for a judicial forum in favor of an arbitral forum. For it to be effective. But Wright dealt with a very easy dispute. I mean, the arbitration reach in that particular case was matters in dispute, okay? And the Supreme Court said, hey, matters in dispute can have two different meanings here. It could either mean contractual disputes, or it can, on the opposite end of the spectrum, mean statutory disputes. And because that ambiguity existed there, it was not a clear and unmistakable waiver.
What about intentional tort? I didn't see it in the collective bargaining agreement. And how does that fit into the argument?
So the reference to either 2745, the specific listing, or intentional tort was not in the collective bargaining agreement. Again, it's our position that it's captured by the two clauses under Article 9, Section 1, and Article 10, Section 4. And the reason for that is that most of the courts have not required a specific listing of statutes or laws in order for there to be a clear and unmistakable waiver under a collective bargaining agreement. And the reason that law exists is explained in Darrington. The Darrington Court from the Third Circuit specifically said that having to have lists of specific laws or what they called magic words would would result in blunting, really, effective negotiation of collective bargaining agreements to include statutory claims. And therefore, not only that like we're here today, everybody's got a mask on today, you wouldn't capture post-contract subsequent occurring laws if you insisted on a listing of statutes. I mean, there'd be a vacuum created almost automatically by requiring that rule of law.
But aren't intentional towards common law claims that make up an abrogation of the workers' compensation statutes?
The intentional tort itself is, Judge, but our collective bargaining agreement specifically says it captures and reaches any employment-related law or statute. 2745 is an employment-related law or statute, and it is for several reasons. First, the General Assembly said it is. The General Assembly embedded the word employment in there twice. Okay? It embedded the word employer within 2745 five times, and it embedded the word employee in there two additional times. That makes 2745 an employment-related statute captured by the collective bargaining agreement. So I want to get on to the listings and the reasons for the Darrington and the gaps is the Bratton case, which was relied upon principally by the appellate court as giving a what they called a bright line effect and bright line test that they wanted to implement for purposes of determining whether a clear and unmistakable waiver has occurred. Bratton has been explained by the subsequent occurring Neely case that came down from the Sixth Circuit just this year. And Neely says that there was no, that Bratton did not hinge on, and it was talking about Kennedy as well. There was a previous case from the Sixth Circuit called Kennedy, and it talked about Wright as well. And it said none of those cases depended upon whether there was a specific reference to a statute, but rather they depended upon whether the reach of the arbitration agreement could be read and understood to capture statutory claims. And in our case, of course, it does. It specifically mentions employment-related laws or statutes or any alleged violations of laws or statutes. And so Neely was a Federal Arbitration Act case. There's a difference. Okay? Bratton was not an FAA case. It was a Labor Management Relations Act case. It did not incorporate, it did not call to forth any of the principles that apply to the FAA. And that's significant here because, as courts know, when you apply the Federal Arbitration Act, there's a whole powerful army of principles behind the Federal Arbitration Act, including that courts must enforce arbitration agreements according to their clear terms. That's one of the bedrocks of the Federal Arbitration Act. And here the clear terms are those set forth in Article 9, Section 1, and Article 10, Section 4. In fact, Neely raised the bar a little bit on that and said courts must rigorously enforce arbitration agreements. And it said that in the exact setting that we're talking about here. It said it within a collective bargaining agreement where the issue was a clear and unmistakable waiver. And it said, notwithstanding the clear and unmistakable test, that you must rigorously enforce laws or statutes. And there's a third principle at foot under the Federal Arbitration Act, and that's called the equal footing provision of the Arbitration Act. You can't have special laws, special rules that apply simply to commercial contracts that don't equally apply across the board to arbitration contracts. And in this case, one of the equal footing violations would occur in that all of the language that the Teamsters and Superior Dairy negotiated is stripped out of the contract and left nugatory and superfluous. In your normal commercial case, this court has held in Sunoco, in Foster Wheeler, that if given a path, if you're given a path to interpretation and application of any commercial contract, and that path can either be you give all the words in the contract meaning in life, or you render some of those terms meaningless and superfluous, you must, and that's the word used by the court, you must take the path that gives life and meaning to all the words of the statute, or all the words of the contract, excuse me.
But you cited 2745.01, and this is liability of an employer for intentional tort, and the section begins essentially that an employer is not liable unless certain things occur. But when it comes to removal by the employer of an equipment safety guard, there is a rebuttable presumption there. So don't you think that something as important as this would have been put into the contract and specifically listed as a statute, not just the statutes that were listed?
Yeah, two points to that. The point of the presumption that exists in 2745 about removal of a guard as being a prima facie evidence of intent, a rebuttable presumption of it, that is a creature clearly of 2745, which goes back to why 2745 is an employment-related law or statute. In terms of the importance of it, Judge, we believe we captured it through the clauses that I mentioned, rather than having specifically mentioned it for the very reasons that the Darrington Court from the Third Circuit, which was adopted, by the way, in the Neely Court when it took a look back at Bratton, it came right down on the side of Darrington in terms of saying, we don't need a listing, we don't need magic words to effectuate a clear and unmistakable waiver of statutory rights under a collective bargaining agreement. Language like ours can effectuate that waiver, notwithstanding what the claim is.
But don't you think if we accept your arguments and go in that direction, that in any future collective bargaining agreements, no labor union is going to be willing to arbitrate anything or to list any statutes or any laws that would be subject to arbitration? I mean, aren't we going to create a problem if we go in your direction?
I don't believe so, Judge. First of all, this union, because it was in the same boat we were in terms of defending that piece of federal legislation, was clearly of the mindset, and we had a mutual intent. And normally, when you have a contractual dispute, you have differences of opinions between the parties about what the intent was. Here, the intent is uniform. Teamsters Local 92 and Superior Dairy both wanted to capture all statutory claims. So I don't think it would blunt or foster a reluctance on behalf of unions to enter into these type of contracts.
Counsel, how do you know that they wanted to include all statutory claims?
Well,
is there language in there that says this refers to all statutory claims?
The specific language is any employment-related laws or statutes, yes, Your Honor. And then there's a secondary provision under Article 10, Section 4, where they subjected the entire grievance and arbitration procedure, the grievance procedures in Article 9, the arbitration procedures under Article 10, to any alleged violations of laws or statutes. And thirdly, there's an affidavit from the representative of Mr. Sinley, who's his federal representative under federal law, 29 USC 159, that's his agent under federal law, that said the intent of the parties here was to capture all statutory claims. So yes, and that's important too, because my colleagues asked that the intent be altogether ignored here, that intent not be looked at because it cuts against them. Yet again, going back to the court's decisions in the past and the M&G Polymers case that says, when you're interpreting and looking at a collective bargaining agreement, the key, as it is in any other type of contract interpretation application exercise, is to seek to determine the intent of the parties. Here, the intent of the parties was uniform. The intent of parties was clear. So,
But why wouldn't the parties just simply have not listed any statutes and said all statutory claims, and then there would be no question?
Well, actually, what you're suggesting there, Justice Bruner, is acceptable under the clear and unmistakable standard. We listed statutes and claims because you understand the bargaining process. We're literally at the bargaining table. And you don't have your revised code in front of you. You don't have your U.S. code in front of you. You are sitting with a committee of union representatives and a committee of company representatives. And when you're doing tentative agreements and hashing out language, it's right there at the bargaining table. So the parties went through a process of, okay, what are the ones that come up most in the employment setting? But then let's be careful not to leave it just to a specific listing. Let's not just leave it as a listing. Okay, let's include precatory language that includes the language I talked about under Article Article 9, Section 1, and Article 10, Section 4.
So intentional torts didn't come up through in those negotiations, apparently?
Well, the specifics of intentional tort, obviously, Justice Donnelly, did not come up. Okay, there's more statutes that didn't come up. I mean, there's statutes in Ohio that protect employees in the event they're summoned for grand jury duty. There's statutes in Ohio that protect employees when it comes to being summoned for criminal proceedings. There's statutes in Ohio that protect employees in the event they have multiple garnishments. There's statutes in Ohio that protect employees in the event they're summoned to a juvenile court proceeding. I mean, there's a whole slew. That's just on the state level. Think of the federal level. I mean, you can't.
But you would think during those negotiations, employers would put intentional torts pretty high on the priority list if they were going to force those into arbitration, don't you think?
I don't know if they were not high on the priority list. It's just that intentional torts are such a rare event. So if you look at the statutes that are mentioned, they were ones that predominantly come up in the employment setting rather than intentional tort, which now, because of the way it's been captured in 2745, requiring specific intent, and substantial certainty now is deliberate intent. It's a rare cause of action to come up.
But it's interesting, though, that the statute on intentional torts specifically deals with removal of an equipment safety guard. And this gentleman who brought the lawsuit was required by his job to go and perform maintenance on the equipment when that occurred. I think I'm having a hard time understanding why this wouldn't have been included.
Again, it wasn't included because when you're sitting at the collective bargaining table and you're negotiating and you're really, we were on the same path, we had the same intent in mind that we are no longer going to be put in the position we were in the Kovacs lawsuit. We were going to stop the pains that come with litigation, both for us and for the Teamsters Union. We both had significant amount of dollars spent in that case. It almost bankrupted the union because they had less money than Superior Dairy, but it almost did. So when we're sitting at the bargaining table and we're negotiating, Justice Bruner, we're thinking about those causes of action that predominantly come up in the employment setting. Title VII, Age Discrimination and Employment Act. And those are the ones we listed, but we were careful also to say, hey, let's not just stop it at a listing. Let's make sure that any statutory causes of action are captured here.
Thank you.
I got a couple minutes left on my time.
No, you don't.
Okay. Thank you, Judge.
Your red light's on.
Thank you. Sorry. Thank you, Justice.
Morning. Honorable members of this court, Chief Justice O'Connor. My name is Michael Elliott. I represent Stephen Senley, the plaintiff appellee herein. May it please the court. We're asking the court to adopt the proposition of law set forth in the amicus brief filed by the Ohio Association for Justice.
Counsel, let me ask you a question.
What do I do with the word any in section 9, subsection 1? Any alleged violation. What do I do? If it doesn't say an alleged violation, including without limitation. It says any.
Well, you have to apply the standard. That's a clear and unmistakable standard. That language in and of itself is not enough. That's why they're going to the employer.
So the word any, I just read out. It doesn't matter.
Under the clear and unmistakable standard, you have to satisfy an express, clear desire. And we know it's just been conceded that the employer intentional statute was not considered, was not included in this particular agreement when it was formed.
So I ignore the word any.
You have to ignore certain words within that language. They had the Kovac decision that had just been decided. That Kovac decision enunciated a clear bright line test that required that they include all various statutes as opposed to the contract claims within the agreement in order to satisfy the standard. I'm not here today to advocate that it has to be that clear bright line test. What I am suggesting is that the proposition of law suggested by the Ohio Association for Justice crystallizes the law in this particular forum. And that's the provision of a collective bargaining agreement mandating arbitration of disputes covers an Ohio employer intentional tort claim only if the arbitration provision clearly and unmistakably identifies employer intentional tort claims as being covered. Here we know that did not happen.
Is that the proposition of law in front of us?
That's the proposition in law set forth in the amicus brief.
But it's not the proposition of law in front of us.
I'm sorry, I don't understand.
It's not the proposition of law in front of us.
That is what I'm suggesting that you.
It's not what we took in as the prop.
Oh, okay. The proposition of law, the first proposition of law, is that they are advocating for a presumption in favor of arbitration. That is clearly not right. That is contrary to every federal and state decision and is set forth in the Penn Plaza decision. Penn Plaza decision adheres to the proposition of law that requires a clear and unmistakable waiver of that requirement or of that particular statutory claim. The second proposition of law, while a clear and unmistakable standard may not require that in every instance one must expressly list the statute, it does require more than just general statements that applies to matters between the parties. We know this is true even in cases that
How much more specific do you need to be than any employment-related matter? That seems abundantly clear what that is, right?
Well, I'm not here today to suggest that that may not include some claims separate and apart from the employer intentional tort claim.
Employer intentional tort claim is something that arises out of the employment relationship, correct?
With all due respect, Your Honor, no, it does not. It is.
You have to have an employer, and you have to have be an employee sure. to have an employer intentional tort. Right?
It's not someone who's walking down the street who gets maimed by some stranger. It does happen
Don't you think that's an employment-related claim?
I do not believe, knowing the context and the history of that statute, I do not believe that's an employment-related claim. I believe it is one that provides for a very limited. In very limited circumstances, a remedy that applies outside of the employment relationship. If it was employment related, you would be subjected to and limited by workers' compensation.
Well, there's all kinds of employment related claims that aren't covered by workers' comp, right?
There are certainly
any kind of claim that
arises out of a personal injury within the context of the employment relationship that's not covered by workers' comp. Other than the employer intentional tort.
So employment related within the, if it's a personal injury, has to be a workers' comp claim? Is that how we're to understand that?
My understanding is any kind of personal injury that occurs on the premises of an employer is subject to workers' compensation, unless, of course, it happens to fall within an employer intentional tort, yes.
Mr. Elliott, let's suppose this did go to arbitration. The arbitrator would be applying 2745.01 or not?
Well, I think that's a good question. I think the arbitrator is bound by laws, but in my experience, the arbitrator is free to do what he or she sees fit under the circumstances. Sometimes they apply laws, sometimes they're more liberal, sometimes they're less liberal. There certainly wouldn't be the same in my opinion, very important oversight of the court system in deciding this type of particular claim. Arbitrators may be very good at dealing with some matters that arise out of collective bargaining agreements, but in this particular instance, I don't think they're well suited. It also ignores the fact that not only is there an arbitration, but there's a grievance process that is also were to win would also subject this claim to that process. And it's a process that has short periods of time. It also requires that the union either accept or not accept the grievance. So there's a lot of other issues that before we say this broad-based employment-related language should cover any and all claims, even those claims that were not limited, and that's been acknowledged here, were not limited in this agreement, should be covered by this process.
No, go ahead. In an action like this, though, assuming this went forward in court, the union doesn't really have any role to play, does it?
The union would not have a role to play. And I would submit, my colleague just indicated that I guess part of the claim against the employer also included the union in the COVAX decision, and he indicated that almost bankrupted the union. I would submit that there would be no union willing to undertake an intentional tort claim, given the nature of the claim, the sophistication that it involves, the cost and expense required to undertake such a claim. So to say to the court, it'll be taken care of, that's simply, in my opinion, not true. It's not going to be something that ever gets.
So if it's arbitration, the union is necessarily drawn in because it involves the collective bargaining agreement. And if it's an intentional tort, that's dealt with in the court between the employee and the employer. The union doesn't play a role. Do I have that maybe oversimplified, but is that correct?
The union is not a party to that proceeding.
Thank you.
Does that answer?
And with the arbitration, the union is involved, correct?
The union would be involved, assuming it undertook the matter. And there are necessary conflicts in that, as I previously pointed out, in the union undertaking such a claim for an individual union member, as opposed to the union as a whole.
Thank you.
So, counsel, the allegation here is that the employer removed a guard, right?
That is part of the allegations, correct.
And then the client lost four fingers?
He did, all but his thumb.
Okay.
Dominant right hand.
So how, tell me, how would the word any encompass that type of intentional conduct by an employer?
The any and all?
Yeah.
The any and all. Well, I'm not sure I understand the question.
You've heard from some of my colleagues on the bench, and they say any means any, so I guess that means everything.
Right.
That's an employment-related action. The employer intentionally did something to maim your client, so that would be covered, and the union would have the right to waive that client's right to go to court on that action.
I mean, I have personal serious reservations about suggesting that. I think that would be a decision for another day. And an intentional act by its very nature should not be prospectively waived. But even if one were to somehow suggest that including that language within the agreement would have effectively waived the right to go to court, this court has long recognized the distinction and the difference between employment-related matters and an intentional tort. They're totally, in Johnson, the court said, injuries resulting from employers' intentional torts, even though committed at the workplace, are totally unrelated to the fact of employment. When an employer intentionally harms his employee, that act affects a complete breach of the employment relationship. And it goes on, and I'm sure the court is well aware of that language. I do not believe anything within the most current version of the statute changes that fact. Employer has always been used as a title for this particular tort, but the tort itself is not something that occurs within the employment relationship. If you're going to take the standard and say that it goes as broadly as it does, even as broad as using the generalized language, any and all statutes that apply to employer-related matters, and employer-related matters is what limits that any and all language, then you have to find that an employer intentional tort, even under those circumstances, is not covered by that language. If there are no other questions, I will go ahead and rest.
Just one more.
Sure.
I'm sure that a trial court would not be limited to 2745.01 in adjudicating an intentional tort involving an employee and employer. Common law would play into this as well, correct?
The common law would also be applicable to the claim. You would have to prove substantial certainty as the statute defines that. But I do not believe that the statute itself covers the entirety of the claim itself.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Counsel, you've used your time. You may take a minute.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Justice Fischer, the response back that any goes away or all goes away is clearly inconsistent with the Federal Arbitration Act. You can't read words out and rigorously enforce them at the same time. Justice Bruner, you asked about, it was the arbitrator required to follow the law. It's embedded in this particular grievance procedure that they must and cannot rule contrary to, amend, alter, or eliminate the provisions of this agreement or eliminate statutes and their developed interpretation by the courts. In terms of the union's role to play, Justice Bruner, you also asked that question. Section 6 of Article 10 opens the grievance and arbitration procedure to an individual employee should the union decide not to pursue their grievance. In other words, it makes it available to the employee, even in the event the union says, hey, we don't want to take your case or we don't think this grievance is worthy of taking, then what it commands is that you come in with your private attorney and use the grievance arbitration process to vindicate your rights under the collective bargaining agreement.
Counsel, what about the statement that an intentional tort by an employer against an employee is not activity within the employment agreement?
Again, I'll go back to 2745.
I mean, you're not, it's a tort.
It's a tort that has to pass through 2745 in order to get any kind of liability. It still has to pass through 2745, whether it's proving the intent, proving the substantial certainty,
right.
Removal
I
of
mean,
the guard.
I know all the ingredients, but that's, it starts out not being an agreement made by the employee with the employer. I'm going to take a job with you, and you know, if you commit an intentional tort against me, you know, I know that's the possibility. I know that, you know, I'm taking that risk when I come in to work with you, that you very well could do you know, something that's going to create an intentional tort. That employees don't do that.
Employers don't do that.
What's that?
Employers don't do that, yes.
Well,
yes.
Neither do that. I mean, it's not contemplated in the employment agreement.
But it is under 2745, Judge. And the language used in our collective bargaining agreement is any and all employment-related statutes. And clearly 2745 is an employment-related statute.
But is it fair to sort of analogize, because workers' compensation statute does not deal with intentional torts. I mean, when an employee comes into work for an employer, and the employee is bound by what's in the workers' compensation laws, but if it's an intentional tort, that's out the window. So why would we make it any different here?
Because 2745 is an employment-related law or statute.
I understand, except that's not all the claims of Mr. Sinley.
It's some of the claims of Mr. Sinley. Certainly the removal of the guard, which is created by 2745, and the inference that comes from that is created by statute under 2745.
But there's no common law addressing of that? It all has to be covered by the statute?
There
is
was,
that your position?
Under Blankenship, there was no law. That came as part of the tradeoff for the passage of 2745, Justice Bruner. So, yes, it is purely statutory.
No more common law?
No, the common law still exists, but it has to pass through 2745.
But doesn't 2745 just exist as an abrogation? There has to be conduct that the employer intentionally inflicted this injury.
Correct.
Right.
Yes,
so,
Judge.
I mean, how is that an employment-related claim? I mean, that's just...
But it's an employment-related statute That's what the words of the collective bargaining agreement include. And 2745 is an employment-related statute. It doesn't say employment-related conduct, or it doesn't say employment-related misconduct. The words of the statute is an employment-related statute. I know I'm out of my time.
You're out of time. You're out of time. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, gentlemen. We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision.